It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown T minus 5, 4, 3. Two, one.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 97.
Eating the brains of creative people to steal their cosmic powers.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And today's guests include Mike Cole, who once wrestled a bear over a peanut. That's your moment when you say hello.
I'm dumbstruck. I can't speak.
Oh, okay. All right. Also, Paul Weimer. How do you say your last name?
It's actually Weimer.
Weimer.
I haven't decided to correct you guys in the couple times you've mentioned it on Duke and Zinc, but that's okay.
Wait, hold on. Why is it that I wrestle a bear over a peanut and he gets to correct the pronunciation of his name?
He has something, too. That just hold on. Just calm down, Mike. It's okay.
All right.
His is coming up. Paul is only here because I stole his German ancestry and won't give it back until the end of this episode.
Oh, that's
and
just
I'm
mean.
Here to take it back.
That's
hey,
right.
Everyone.
You're going to have to fight me for it.
And then in that case, I want to call him Weimer.
You may if you so choose.
But not till the end of the episode.
And not until the end when he gets it back. And then, of course, Stina Light is also here, who currently owns one half of Sinead O'Connor thanks to an early Christmas present.
See, again, like, I
thank
Stina
you.
Had the best
Hello.
One.
Hello.
That was the best one.
Mike feels a little gypped right now.
I do. I want half Sinead O'Connor. You can have the damn bear. Can have the damn peanut.
Well, next time we'll get you. So, today's episode, the hope is we're going to talk about a particular topic. Although we may end up talking about things that have nothing to do with genre. Because, well, there have been enough conversations before we recorded this on dirty things. And Mike is sure to bring it up because he's a filthy human being. So today's discussion point is the question, how do science fiction and fantasy change our perspective of the world and vice versa? So who wants to start?
I will.
Awkward silence. Penis.
Oh, everybody says it at once. We'll start with Paul.
The way science fiction changed my perspective of the world and vice versa started on a day about mid-90s. I saw an article about transparent aluminum, and I meet being made by the Navy as a possible building material. And I immediately thought back to Star Trek IV, where transparent aluminum was a key plot point. Scotty giving the rights to that material in order to get the stuff for the whales, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, I came up with the admonition then that we were living in a science fiction present, and I've had that as a tagline on my poor neglected little blog ever since. We are in a science fiction present. We may not have got the spaceships or the rays or the rocket guns or the flying cars, but have you seen an iPhone? It's technology beyond the dreams of 50s, 60s, 70s, or even 80s science fiction writers. We are in a science fiction world today, and most of us don't even recognize it.
That's because we're lazy.
You know, the only person on this show who has gotten a science fiction present so far is Stina, who got half Sinead O'Connor.
That's only science fictional if it was like the Borg version of Sinead O'Connor.
So then she got a fantasy present.
Otherwise, totally just a fantasy present.
As far as I know, you cannot keep half of a person alive.
Unless it's a fantasy novel.
Or a science. It, you know,
I suppose science. If it was a science fiction novel. Yeah.
She
okay.
could have been bisected with transparent aluminum.
Oh, this is a short story waiting to happen. The woman who had half of Sinead O'Connor.
Okay, Paul has a really, really good point, though. I actually just had a conversation with my husband about this because we were talking about, I don't even know what the hell we were talking about, but it came up that, you know, back in the day I had read, what's the book, Cyberpunk, Neal Stephenson, Snow Crashed, and Diamond Age. And obviously in those futures, and William Gibson to an extent as well, you have the corporate control of the entire world, and you have the enclaves and all that jazz. And I was like, yeah, I don't think we're really living in that type of world, though. And he was like, really? You don't think that? And I paused and was like, okay, really? I'm just an idiot. And yes, you're right. We're totally living in a cyberpunk world, which is probably why nobody writes cyberpunk anymore.
Yeah, and I agree with Paul, too. I talked to my students about this very thing, about the iPhone, and one of the things that I had to explain what cyberpunk was to them, because they'd never heard of it before, which is shocking, because they've seen enough movies that they know what it is. But in any case, I had to explain to them, and one way I did that was, well, we live in a cyberpunk world, and if you just think about the technology that's in this room, and I basically had them raise their hands, who has an iPhone or an iPod Touch or some variation of a smartphone of any kind, and almost all of their hands went up, and I was like, You live in a science fiction universe. I mean, this is beyond, like, people were shocked when the calculator was invented. And just imagine how they would look at something like an iPhone today. I mean, Einstein's head would have exploded.
If you think about the flip phone, I was working at Motorola when the flip phones were made, and they did specifically invent them because everyone was a Trekkie fan. Also, the Bluetooth is very much a cyberpunk thing as well. So I'm with
very
Paul.
Much so. Yeah. And then we're going to get the Google glasses, and
yes, absolutely.
That almost takes me to buy my bionic eye. But I think I have this thing where until I get my bionic eye, we're not living in a science fiction world.
Lazy bum.
I know. Well, it's my standard by which I judge science fiction world.
We only live in a science fiction world if it suits Jen's biology.
Yes.
This is the rule now. This is great. So, is it just till you get the bionic eye, or once you get that, you're like, you know, it's really not a science fiction world. I need a spaceship with like an alien pilot that brings me lemonade.
Well, I would prefer an eye that is not only lets me actually see out of my eye, but in I think it's Snow Crash or maybe it's Diamond Age, there's the dude that has like a gun, minigun in his eye, and I suppose that could be my next requirement.
Oh, that could be very dangerous, very, very dangerous. I also read an article about nanotechnology being used to combat brain cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's let Mike get in here because he's been trying really badly.
No, I mean, you guys, you know me. If people want to get a word in edgewise, you need to cut me off. So feel free to do that throughout the show in the interest of other people getting to talk at all. What I was going to say is that we talked a lot about technology. But one of the things that science fiction does well is anticipates and extrapolates social evolution and how we change culturally. And I think that in that regard, we are living in a science fictional universe, but maybe not the kind of science fiction we thought. And there are schools of science fiction. I'll give one example, which is, you know, clearly there's older science fiction tended to be utopian in its outlook. Nowadays, most of the popular science fiction I'm seeing is apocalyptic. Eco-apocalyptic in the case of Paolo Bacigalupi and Tobias Bekele, epically apocalyptic in the case of like Warhammer 40K, which is some of the most popular, it's genre media tie-in, but it's still, you know, some of the most popular science fiction that's selling these days. And I think that we could tie into any number of different kinds of science fictional universes in terms of how society is evolving. I live in a world right now which is, or rather I should say United States, which is doesn't look at all socially like I had imagined it would ever look. It is both more progressive than I ever imagined America would be, and is also at the same time experiencing a conservative revival that I never imagined I would ever see, both in religion and in terms of culture. If you had told me that Don't Ask, Don't Tell would be repealed even 3 years ago, I would have told you were crazy. And I was
really?
And I was the officer in charge of, or rather, I shouldn't have given myself too much credit. I assisted with training my guys for the repeal of it. And that was an amazing and experience for me. I would never have thought that that would have happened. And
I saw things like that, you know, even 10 years ago when my husband was in, only because of the general acceptance of people his age. And of course, the people his age were going up in the ranks and everything. And, you know, now they're all tech sergeants and whatnot. And
Tech Sergeant Chet.
What?
Galaxy Quest, come on.
Oh, you're such a dork. Anyway, so I totally saw it just because there was so much acceptance, at least in the Air Force, and I was never sure how, you know, the other branches were dealing with things like that. But I still totally see your point. I mean, culturally, and you and I and Sean and talked about this in terms relation to Kratman's issue of, you know, in the future we won't change at all society and there will never be gender acceptance or equality, and you're like, wait, what? How does that even make sense? I mean, yeah, currently we kind of have backlashes against it, but...
Jen, you remember before when you brought up the crap and I said the crap? I thought you said the crap.
Yes.
So what's happened now is I just heard you say Kratman. And I think that, like, I'm probably wrong in that. That wasn't what you meant.
No, it's totally Kratman with a T.
Didn't need that at all.
Yeah. Right. So yeah. What was his name?
Tom Kratman. We talked about women in the military because his general view was that
it's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen ever.
And it would be bad for the military, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Oh. Yikes. Yikes. I remember that. Yes. Yikes.
Yeah. Shit. That was a special moment. Yeah.
Well, you know, the Marines just opened their combat infantry school to females.
Did they seriously?
Yeah. I blogged about it tweeted about it.
Ooh, that's nice.
See, that's the future I want is I don't agree with just blanket denying women access. I think, like, why don't you just judge them based on the merits? Like, if a woman shows up, right, and she does the whatever is for training, I have no idea what people train for in the Marines, and she matches all of the men, what should stop her from being to serving under that capacity? I don't understand.
Thank you so much. I totally agree with you. I totally agree.
This is the problem with being a serving officer, is that I really, my opinion on this is irrelevant. I can do is carry out the policy dictated to me by my civilian overlords. You know, I do, it's my job to carry out the policy that you folks set. And if you set greater equality for women, then that was what I will step out smartly to do. And if you set less equality for women, I will, granted more reluctantly, step out smartly to administer it.
Well, that's the interesting thing I think about the military, and this is related to this, because Tobias Bekele on his blog, he often will blog about very interesting things about the U.S. military and how it is oddly a rather progressive institution. I mean, one of the things the military is doing is it's actually adjusting itself for what it assumes is going to be a much more open the passages up north. I don't know what the proper
Arctic
term is.
Arctic passages.
Right, the Arctic passages. If those are going to be more open, it's going to change the way we engage on the sea, that they have to – they're playing with new kinds of technologies, like, you know, renewable sources, solar, those kinds of things. That these kinds of things are going on in the military right now, that it's adjusting in all these rather interesting ways. And that's – I think when you talk about, you know, yes, the military is taking – you know, it has to just follow the orders. But it's also, oddly enough, one of the few institutions this country has that is really good at adapting.
Yeah,
maybe we should take a page off of that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I dated a second lieutenant for like 7 years in the Army.
It's not a second lieutenant for all that time.
Yeah, no, well, I wasn't a second lieutenant for all that time. No, he wasn't. He started off in the ROTC. When I met him, but yeah, they did. In a lot of ways, the military does seem to be very, very progressive, and then in other ways, not so much. But I think you could say that about a lot of different groups.
That's true. Yeah.
You know, it just out of a point of pride, you know who the real leader in Arctic operations for the military is, right?
Coast Guard.
The Coast Guard.
Coast Guard.
I'm just guessing here.
Yep, that's us.
Yay!
Because the Coast Guard are badasses.
Yeah, and the Navy is by far leading in terms of renewable energy. So it's been interesting to watch the direction that the military is going with.
Yeah.
Sean, when you say that we're badasses, is that a way of insinuating that our posteriors are of inferior quality?
No, I'm implying that the Coast Guard is awesome.
Okay.
Yeah. And you're going to soon write a book called The Coast Guard. We Are Awesome.
I was thinking I was going to have to hit the gym and do squats or something.
No, no. Okay, so kind of circling back, one thing that I thought that we would be interesting to talk about is, because we've talked about this in terms of how reading science fiction has changed our view of kind of the world around us and how we might perceive the future or and things like that. But I was curious, too, is about how do we, those of us as readers, we're all readers of genre fiction, how does that, like, reading science fiction or fantasy change the way we read or the way we approach the literature's world, as it were? And I think that'll be very different because Stina primarily writes fantasy. Mike writes, I mean, we essentially write fantasy, but it's got like badass military guys in it and it's sort of in the present and it's kind of cool. And Paul, I mean, he doesn't do anything, so whatever. teasing. But I guess that's my curiosity is how does reading science fiction or fantasy sort of, how do you have to adjust yourself to read that as opposed to reading, I was going to say James Joyce, but then that is a bad example, so never mind. But have at it, people.
Can I actually adjust the question?
Okay.
No.
Okay.
Shut up, Jen. Let him go.
instead of the question you've asked me, I'm going to answer the question, do I like Neapolitan ice cream? No. No, I'll adjust your question and say, for me, it really started with Dungeons & Dragons.
Yes!
We are all such nerds here.
Oh my god, that was a total nerdgasm.
I feel really accepted right now, and that's
accepted. We love you.
Thanks. Now I feel accepted and uncomfortable. the thing with Dungeons and Dragons is that, I mean, I'll consider that reading because really it's a textual experience, right?
Yeah.
And it's about reading and writing and storytelling and all of those things. What I don't know about the rest of you, but I started out, I think, like most nerds, as a socially poorly adjusted, physically weak, awkward kid. And I had a tough time making friends, and I had a tough time fitting in. And I thought, and initially, the world of D&D and comic books and fantasy novels was a refuge where I could imagine a life other than the one that I was having a tough time in.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's a common experience, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's actually so. Just you, Mike. Completely.
Okay, yeah, I'm the only one. The rest of you guys were all like captains of the football team, and
I was Captain America.
I gotta be totally honest. Mike's the only one I don't believe had that experience. When you look at his profile picture, just don't buy it.
Sean, it's totally true. In fact, if you friend me on Facebook, there's tons of pictures of me with hair down in my butt, and
he is such a nerd. Seriously, oh my God. You need to go look at his Facebook pictures.
Dude, I spent the vast majority of my youth in my mom's basement playing D&D and Talisman.
Fulfilling a stereotype.
Yeah. Literally in my mom's basement. I'm not kidding. But the point, the point was this, is that when I played D&D, I always played fighters and paladins. And there's a writer named Ethan Gilsdorf. He writes for Salon, and he's written a book called Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks, which is about sort of the sociology of D&D nerds. And he interviewed both me and fantasy author Peter V. Brett. Are you folks familiar with
him? Yeah.
He's an amazing writer and a good friend. But he interviewed both of us. And he sort of asked us what D&D did for us. And I answered in the article, and he published that article on Salon.com. There's a link to it on my website in the public affairs tab. But I sort of realized that I was playing fighters and paladins because I was trying to imagine myself as someone other than the person I was. Here I was, this really skinny, powerless young boy, imagining myself as a warrior. And then my mom took me to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and I remember looking at these suits of armor there, and my mom teaching me about what a knight was. And I realized that the warriors that I was imagining myself being in fantasy, there was a real variant of that. And when you add in reading fantasy to that, what I was doing was stretching my brain around the possibility of the person I could be. And that's what fantasy did for me. If you're going to change who you are, you first have to imagine who you want to be. And
exactly. In order... I couldn't agree more because I did the same thing. I played paladins and fighters. Right. And I used to think of myself as I was a very mousy person. I was very shy. all of that stuff. And it actually took playing D&D for me to realize that I could actually be brave when necessary and stand up for myself and other people and all of that. That actually took role-playing games to bring that out. It was a huge thing for me. Huge.
See, now what's funny is I played druids, which are, you know, essentially the most pacifistic character that you could possibly play in D&D.
Well, actually, wait a minute.
Because it played into, well, that and I'm a hippie. So, I made the
decision,
that
I was a hippie. Not
well, you're
way.
Totally a hippie, but I made the decision to kind of play to what I already was. I never used D&D as that outlet. I actually used science fiction more as that outlet of imagining what I could be. I never became those things, but it, for me, it was because when I was 8, I had this whole dream of going into the military. I mean, you eventually did that, Mike, but that's what I wanted to do with my life. And then I went blind when I was 8 years old. So I had to use the book science fiction more than I did fantasy, because fantasy to me was always kind of like, that was my escape. Science fiction was always my imagining of what could be and what I could do with my life. And I mean, think there's some aspect of being more antisocial in science fiction, maybe, for me. So
I want to first, Jen, refute your assertion that druids are pacifistic, because once you get up to like 10th level and you...
Well,
and
yeah, then you start...
You have to fight to be an initiate of each circle, you have to fight and kill the guy ahead of you, or gal, in this case. And that's from first edition. I don't know how you folks do it in Pathfinder, but in first edition, that's the rule.
I always played second edition. I never played first. So maybe I think it got less difficult to go up in levels.
The final thing though, that I want to say, and where it really came home for me and came full circle, is that, and it really makes me so grateful. And as a matter of fact, Fortress Frontier, the second book in my Shadow Ops series, is dedicated to J.R.R. Tolkien and Gary Gygax for this reason. Is that when Admiral Acton commissioned us, our graduating class from Officer Candidate School out of the Coast Guard Academy, and I'll never forget that when we raised our right hands and we said the words, our words, you know, swear to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, I had a running voice in the back of my head saying, I am the sword in the darkness, I am the watcher on the walls. It's the words of the Night's Watch from A Song of Ice and Fire. And it was a really resonant moment, because for me, it was coming home that like this, that this was not a phase. It was not a quirky little hobby. It was a bone deep, lifelong commitment to a literature that empowered me and enabled me. And I am absolutely and 1,000% the man I am today, officer, operator, master's degree, book deal, anything I've ever achieved, because of those comic books, those role-playing games, and those fantasy novels. To answer your question, Sean, how has it changed me? It's revolutionized me. It's empowered me. It's the most important thing in my life.
What Mike said.
Yeah, I mean, that actually brings me to the fact that you get the ideals. The thing that fantasy always did for me was that it gave such amazingly... wonderful ideals of honor and respect and all those other great things about being a human being.
Absolutely.
That's what I always tried to, in terms of fantasy, that aspect I did try to live up to. And that's, it taught me, I think, to be who I am. But at the same time, and I don't know if I've shared on the show before, one of the first things that did it for me was actually ElfQuest. It's, Sina, you and I have talked about this, I think. Did other people read it too?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Sure.
Okay. There we go. ElfQuest, most awesome thing ever, right? I was 8 when I went blind. My godfather, for my next birthday, gave me the first 4 graphic novels of the ElfQuest series. And I, being kind of a reclusive kid and a big reader, I brought those to school. And the friendship group that I developed out of reading those books became my D&D group, because we're all such nerds, and became lifelong friends. And it drastically changed. Like, I felt like that decision, that point in time, being handed those books, because even though I read, you know, comic books at home and I read fantasy novels at home, I never had like that public display of nerd. until I got the ElfQuest novels. And then I brought them to school and everybody was like, ooh, nerd, awesome, and loved me. And we became friends. But I felt like it set me on a different path than where I had been up until that point.
For me, the whole nerd approval thing didn't happen until college.
That's sad.
Well, you know, it happens.
That's true.
But really, I'm a late bloomer, a hugely late bloomer. And a lot of that had to do with being raised in a misogynist environment and being told I couldn't do a lot of things that I wanted to do. I lived through books quite often. That's why I spent so much time with my nose in books, because I could be, you know, a warrior if I wanted to be, and I could have that whole honor and the whole, you know, sticking up for myself and not feeling like a second class citizen shtick. It was nice. But I really do feel that because I felt so oppressed growing up, it was useful later in life, because nowadays it's like anytime anybody tells me I can't do something is like the instantly I try to do it with all my might. So it's dangerous. A useful thing. It's a useful thing. Oh, well, it's useful.
I'm just imagining all the things that someone tells you can't do that you really shouldn't do.
Well, you know, within reason. But
I mean, I know it's it seems trite, but this is a good example of this. My mother, who will inevitably listen to this show and yell at me for what I'm about to say, so sorry, Mom. Raised me, and she told me, "You're bad at math and science."
Typical, though. Go ahead. Yeah. Happens to so many kids.
Jen, don't you do that to your children?
Oh no.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. That's right, Jen. You yell at your children that they're bad at
it. I just yell at my children, but
over random
I'm otherwise
stuff, yeah.
A perfect parent, and I tell them that they're amazing at everything, which will probably screw them up just as much as telling them they suck. But whatever. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, but the thing is, right? So what happens? It becomes a fact on the ground.
Yeah.
I like Stina's story because it's exactly that. Imagination is the way to counter that. And the reality of it is I wound up a computer engineer for a few years. So I'm not bad at math and science. I'm excellent at math and science. Just like anyone can be excellent at pretty much anything, with the exception of, you know, being a linebacker if you're not big enough or that sort of thing.
Exactly. I mean, my parents, I was told that I could not be a writer because I was female. And here I am. God.
Which doesn't here even make sense, but, you know.
I was told I can't have babies because I'm male.
And not quite the same, but okay. No, right.
And Arnold Schwarzenegger proved everybody wrong. Just...
In Junior.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh, God. It was such a bad movie.
It was awesome. No.
This conversation has gotten really heavy, though, so I was hoping that someone...
So you had to interject the lights.
Well, someone should have a good fart joke. Maybe Paul, did you want to... No.
I don't have a fart joke on hand, sorry.
No, he still has to earn his German ancestry back, though, so he's got a huge deficit to make up.
All right, fair enough.
Yeah.
So, start talking in German accent, Paul, right
wait,
now.
Wait, is the
implication... Yeah. For me, Dungeons & Dragons and science fiction and fantasy were... So
I think your German listeners may resent the implication that Germans like fart jokes.
We only have one German listener.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Anywho, where were we?
I was going to put in my two cents.
Okay, go, Paul. Have at it.
Dungeons and Dragons and science fiction and fantasy were, for me, in the end, more about escapism. It was, I came late to identifying with characters in novels when, for most of my life, I really keyed on world building. That's the thing I read for most of the novels. I imagined myself in On the Ring World or in Middle Earth, but as XBs of myself rather than as Aragorn or as Beowulf Schaefer or any of the other characters. And science fiction and fantasy gave me tools to survive sometimes a very unhappy real life, mainly because I'm shy, introverted, a nerd, and all the problems, all that goes with those problems. And science fiction and fantasy gave me an outlet where I could be myself and stick my nose in a book. Not exactly the most social thing. I've gotten better since. I'm talking here on a podcast. I talk to people on Twitter all the time, sometimes too much, and comment on every blog in the universe. But back then when I was in the 80s, when I was 13, I thought Dungeons and Dragons was the bee's knees. And it's made me into the person I am today. Maybe not quite as radical as, say, Mike with going into the military, but it's forged. It's the crucible in which I have been, the soul of my existence has been forged all the same.
Cool. You know, I think the best way to encapsulate this experience, and it is kind of frankly choking me up to hear basically the same thing said from everybody on the podcast, because I really do think, like, we always talk about it, nerddom as a tribe, right? People always use that term.
Oh, absolutely.
And it feels that way. And
you're my people.
Yeah, well, exactly. And basically what we're sort of having here is a love fest. And Sean, before you say anything, I don't mean that in the nasty erotic orgy way. I mean that in the sort of family way.
I know how you mean it, baby.
Are you going to massage my shoulders, Mike? Because now would be the appropriate time.
But is that I use references from the media that I love to encourage myself and define my life the same way that I think a religious person would quote the Bible to themselves to encourage. Let me give you some examples here. When I have been in really powerful romantic relationships, I always describe them in terms of the recognition that Wendy and Richard Pini came up with in ElfQuest.
Totally.
And I've used the term before, soul meets soul when eyes meet eyes, which is a direct quote. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think other people might even use, Corinthians 13 or the Song of Solomon or whatever. There are two other quotes. Logan Ninefingers is a character from Joe Abercrombie's First Law trilogy. And he has a thing he says that his father told him, one of his, you can never have too many knives, but that's not what I'm referring to. He says, it's better to do a thing than live in fear of it. And I say that to myself constantly whenever I feel overwhelmed or I'm walking into a situation and it's sort of the same equivalent of who dares wins. And well, you don't know unless you try or whatever, but those words, which are the words of a fantasy character in a fantasy novel, have gotten me through some incredible contingencies and some real crises in my life where I've really been like, I don't know how I'm going to get through this, but oh shit, I'm not going to let fear stop me. And then I know a friend who has the litany of against fear of the Bene Gesserit tattooed on his thigh. Fear is
absolutely. That one has seen me through quite a bit. Actually,
a ton. Yeah, totally agree.
A little death. And then the last one is Daenerys Targaryen or Targaryen in one of the, I think, Clash of Kings. I don't know if she says it in the first one. Keeps saying, "If I look back, I am lost. If I look back, I am lost." And there's so many disasters in my life, which when I begin dwelling on them, I can just say to myself, "If I look back, I am lost," and I move forward. But the point being that fantasy and science fiction has, for me, become those kinds of major soul touchstones that empower me to deal with crises in my life. So it's funny, Sean, because you sort of ask of like, you know, how does reading it change our impact on literature? And I the only thing I can compare it to is I can compare it to the role that religion plays in people's lives when they're raised on it from the very beginning. Just as I think a deeply religious person leans on faith to help them encapsulate the world and to get them through crises, I literally lean on the pantheon of science fiction and fantasy to do it.
The question then is...
I was diagnosed with cancer like 10 years ago. And the interesting thing is what actually saw me through that period of my life was a copy of Terry Pratchett's The We Free Men. And that whole part where at the end of where Tiffany Aching is talking about her confrontation with the evil queen and her saying, "You have no power over me," essentially. I mean, that book means a lot to me, a great deal to me. Because I did read it while I was going through that time in my life. And everything, it was terrifying. It was very terrifying.
Yeah. Now,
but, you know, everything is great now. So I haven't had any recurrence
Go Cancer Survivors!
Yay! So awesome. But I just wanted to say that that's I feel the same way about science fiction that it and fantasy.
There's an interesting thing about Stevenson's Diamond Age. The aspect of the young lady's illustrated primer that goes to the little girl whose name I forget right now, Nell or something. I always wanted to be able to hand that book to like a younger me or to like I had a decent childhood, so maybe not me, but a kid who has been abused or is going through really tough times, whatever. I always wanted to be able to hand them that book and say, see, this book will help you get through everything that you're going through. You can see, you know, that this child, everything turns out okay in the end. Even in the books that not everything turns out okay, can still use them as kind of a guide, a way to draw yourself out of whatever crap happens to be happening in your life. And I think that's really what did it for me as a kid and even now as an adult, is that, you know, that it draws me out of the crap. Science fiction and fantasy, that's that type of book genre has done it for me. And I imagine other people can use other types of fiction to do the same thing, or even potentially nonfiction. But I think the thing that makes science fiction and fantasy different is that they're so much more accessible as children.
Yeah, yeah. And particularly, I think this also helps explain some of the popularity of YA, science fiction and fantasy. I think the best examples I can think of this are, if you guys do, and do any of you remember Lloyd Alexander's The Chronicles of Pride Aim?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's Taran, he's a kid, he's an assistant pig keeper. I mean, it's like, what could be the lower occupation than that? and yet he is able to raise himself out of that. He's able to empower himself and sort of and become a great hero. And I'm Greg Von Eekhout's The Boy at the End of the World is a great science fiction YA novel that's more recently come out. But it's the survivor of the apocalypse of humanity who's sort of ejected into the world, wounded and ignorant and broken and able to become the savior of humanity. And I think that even as adults, we feel powerless. You know, to steal a page from your book, Stina, Get Cancer. I can't think of an experience that could be more, make you feel more powerless and helpless than to be stricken with cancer. And it helps us to imagine the possibility of coming out of that. And I think that's an incredibly, incredibly powerful medium. And I'm reminded of, do you guys remember Dan Savage's It Gets Better campaign?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
I love Dan Savage. I just think the man's an absolute hero. I think that in a way, YA science fiction and fantasy is the It Gets Better campaign for nerds.
Yeah.
It's sort of saying, you know, yeah, you're in your mom's basement playing D&D now and getting the crap kicked out of you and, you know, no girl within 1,000 miles will ever talk to you, but
guy.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank
gender
you.
Neutral here.
You have the power to change that. You really do.
Well, that was an interesting thing. Like when people talk about science fiction and they say it's so pessimistic, I always say, but it's a book in any book, doesn't matter if it's dystopia or not. It's a book in which humanity is still around. Which seems to me a pretty optimistic thought, that even in 300 years, if we're terrible at governance, still in 300 years, we're still here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I like dystopia fiction. I really do, because it helps show like the worst case scenario, and it demonstrates ways of getting out of that.
It makes
me feel hopeful that people would rise against it, and that something might be done, at least attempted. That makes me actually feel pretty hopeful. I know that's probably the opposite of the way most people feel about that kind of fiction, but that's how I feel about it.
Go ahead, Jen.
I have to say, I totally agree. I think, especially like with zombie fiction, does a really good job of showing the repercussions, you know, like the human aspect of it. You know, the fact that the zombies aren't actually that scary. It's everybody else that's terrifying. And they go through all the different sort of societal structures that could occur, post-apocalypse, and, you know, which ones might work better and which ones will just fail miserably. I love reading those and thinking, oh, so we might survive as long as we can settle on this societal model, we might be okay. And as long as we don't do these certain steps, we might actually be okay. However,
exactly.
You know, we end up as like some sort of,
you know, this conversation has been very intelligent and very, very cerebral and serious. So I just want to point out to listeners that before we started recording, we were so stupid that if you were to turn off the lights, we would have just sat there drooling. Like, I mean, you've never heard more inane conversation in your life. So I don't want to give, I don't want your readers basically to come away with the impression that we are in any way normal.
Smart.
Or normal lights, yeah.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for bringing it back down to earth for us.
Yeah.
I'm here to help. That's what I do. I'm with the government and I help people.
That's your job? Is that one of your in your job description? You know, make sure always to bring people down to earth. Yeah, I don't know if I have quite the same experience as everybody else. Well, maybe. No, I do. I do, actually. You know, because I didn't play a lot of D&D when I was a kid. By kid, I mean like a teenager. I actually played Magic the Gathering, which might say something about me, because in Magic the Gathering, you're not playing an imaginary character. You're actually pretty much playing God, which I think explains something about my own God complex. But I did grow up on Star Wars a lot, which I know is not literature, but I watched the hell out of Star Wars.
Wait a minute. Why is Star Wars not literature?
Well, it's a movie.
It still falls under the definition of literature.
Well, I didn't read the screenplay.
Hold on a second. No, no, no. Literature is a more expansive definition. It's a good thing I'm in front of a computer, because dictionary.com, here we come.
Oh, my God.
Oh, boy. Here we go.
See, no. Go ahead. Take on a nerd. See what happens.
Go for it. Let's see what happens. Oh, yeah. I want to know.
Nerd versus nerd. It's like spy versus spy, but a little different.
You got to make sure it's a read.
Literary work or production?
Any work or production?
A literary work or production. So, writings in which expression and form and connection. So, but I take it if you go with the definition 5 here, literary work or production, I think a movie would fall into that. A comic book would fall into that. I consider literature to be a body of media in which something in a written form is expressed, and that would include a movie. And I tell you this, Sean, because I know you care, and it really furthers the conversation to have this nitpicking, detailed discussion over the definition of a word.
Yes, it really does. I mean,
so do you see why nobody likes me? Because I think we're getting at the heart of that right now.
No, we still like you.
We like you.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about it, you know? Jen will still kiss you at the end.
Oh. Then
what, I get to kiss someone?
Yes.
Yeah.
I hope it's Tina.
I love this. Like, every time Paul talks now, he's just going to do, like, a really bad German accent.
We're going to end up offending our whole one German listener.
Oh, he likes fart jokes anyway. Go ahead.
Oh, my goodness.
Did I miss anything brilliant while I was gone?
Yes, I got schooled by Mike about what literature is, which apparently he's included movies in literature now.
Movies are literature?
Apparently.
Yeah, Natarlich.
But yeah, so I watched Star Wars when I was a kid. I played Magic the Gathering. I drank Citra by the caseful. Does anyone else remember Citra?
No.
Sorry, it was Jolt for me.
What? Okay, Paul remembers Citra.
Jolt,
Citra was
12. How old are you?
Me?
She's
you're
like
young.
I'm 34.
Oh, well, maybe not that.
Rub that in his face.
I'm older than you. It's okay.
So Paul remembers what Citra is, and Citra was amazing, wasn't it, Paul?
I only had a couple cans. I recall finally where exactly I had them. They were in the Staten Island Ferry Terminal, actually Whitehall on the Manhattan side. I drank them coming back from a midnight showing at the American Museum of Natural History of Laser Pink Floyd.
And when you were coming back, the Staten Island Ferry was escorted by small armed craft from my unit.
No gloating there, though.
Yeah, none at all.
No gloating.
No. Well, okay, Paul's deficit just ran up a little bit because he did not appreciate Citra as much as I did.
Now, Citra's the stuff that you burn to keep bugs away, right?
No, Citra was this
fraud.
Yeah.
Citra was this amazing drink. It's sort of like Squirt, but good. by Coca-Cola, and they had it for a while. I think they've changed to like Mellow Yellow and like I don't know whatever. But it was the most amazing just drink. And my friends and I, it was on sale one day for like.
$2.50. I've had Citra.
Yes, and we bought four cases, and those were gone in like a day and a half.
No, I'm sorry. The nerd drink is Jolt.
No, it was Surge, actually.
Mountain Dew, brother. Mountain Dew. Fritos.
Mountain Dew, that was later.
What do you mean later? I'm older than you. You don't know from later. You're 12.
I do, too. Mountain Dew was not as popular as a nerd cola until after Jolt.
Dude, Mountain Dew has been the official drink of IT people since IT first, before I, when it was just I. Didn't even have a T yet.
Yes, but then
Jolt
was introduced, and it had such a high caffeine count that everybody switched to Jolt.
But I have to side with Mike Cole on this one. I'm
God! Yeah, we can start drinking Mountain Dew later.
is that your like chicken impression? Is that where this is going?
No.
Okay. Well, why don't we pull back around? So everybody has, I think, shared their life experiences, very deep, deep experiences in their lives about how genre fiction has changed them irreparably. Mike, worst of all, because he says he's in the military, but really he's become a dictator of a small island off the coast of Madagascar. But okay. Yeah, it's okay.
What about the place for peanuts?
Yes, well, there are lots of peanuts there. They're just all protected by bears.
I'm so glad you clarified that he said peanuts, because
there's been a lot of misinterpretation this show.
Yeah. So why don't we sort of like wind down here? I mean, does anyone have any sort of last thoughts about this particular topic?
I do want to say this. There's an expression now that you hear a lot, which is sort of geek is chic. I don't know if you folks have heard that.
Nick Mamatas has ripped that apart, I think.
Yeah, that's right. He did have a cool blog post on that, which was one of the topics we were going to discuss, but we couldn't because Sean wouldn't let us. The thing about that is that I it's interesting for me to watch all of these things that had such deep emotional resonance that were seminal to me, that created who I am, have all of a sudden, and they were always mine. You know what I mean? Like it was this thing that it was a language. It was a vocabulary that the five of us had that other people didn't. And that way, when the world was mean to me, I could say, well, that's okay, because really, and a lot of religions do this, you know, we're the chosen people, you know. So I sort of felt like the chosen, you know, as part of the secret special tribe, which had this special language. And now all of a sudden it belongs, you know, you go to Comic-Con and it's Hollywood is there, right? I'm going to San Diego Comic-Con. I should be speaking there. My publisher tells me I'm going to be out there in July. And, you know, it's not a con like I know cons, right? It's not the five of us in a corner of the Hilton making inside jokes before we go into a panel with five people that's going to talk about something like, you know, unicorns. Do they poop rainbows? You know, it's really going to be Hollywood, and it's going to be beautiful people and, you know, models with fake elbows and all that stuff.
To Middle Earth. Now get lost.
Yeah. And like, and the thing is, like, I'll never forget. I went on Facebook and like there was this obviously like soft porn model. And she was in all this like, you know, raw Batman and Robin costumes and like a Firefly brown coats outfit, but very sexed up. And she was like, I'm queen of the nerds. And I'm looking at her like, no, you're not. You know, like you're a model who's glommed on to the fact that HBO is running Game of Thrones and Spider-Man and Iron Man are big in the theaters. And like, this is, and now you're laying claim to this thing that I grew up with. And I feel this incredible sense of, you know, and I know I should be expansive and embracing everyone and being like, welcome to the tribe. But part of me feels this sort of mean provincial sense of like, get out of my house.
Yes.
Get out.
Okay. See, and geek women, I think, are feeling that a lot more than geek men, because we really have been co-opted by the hot chicks in cosplay.
Yes.
And there's like the people who are, you know, hosting G4 and that whole crew, and they're doing their, there was that hot geek girl, gamer nerd video,
the nerdy
video.
Bird. The nerdy bird. And like,
Bagline is, no, like, I love the Nerdy Bird. She's awesome. But I also have never felt like she's the hot girl, so maybe that's what it is.
Her tagline is, no, I won't marry you. To which my response is, I never proposed.
But yeah, I mean, it's really hard as somebody, you know, it's like, I am not the most attractive woman on the planet, and I am proud of that fact. Thank you very much. I don't want to be, because that seems like it would be a pain in the ass and way too high maintenance.
I don't know, Jen, you're kind of hot.
Shut up, honey.
True.
So, like, and I see that, and it's on television, it's in the movies, you know, Rihanna is starring in fucking Battleship and Mad Tour, but, you know, I want to see, it's like, Sean and I were just talking about this in terms of Doctor Who, and the next chick who's going to play the Doctor Who's next companion. She's not at all nerdy. She's a hot girl. And I'm like, I don't want to watch that. It's just not interesting.
Right. We kind of.
I don't share experience with people who grew up as attractive, probably more social than I was, you know, and are now in Hollywood. No matter how much they may try to sympathize with me, empathize with me, you know, be me, they're not, and they never will.
I do want to say this, though, that as much as we're all identifying on this one thing, it is definitely a failing on our part. The reality of it is that, you know, we love a literature and a medium, and other people are loving it, too. And whether or not they grew up with the same experiences we do, that's a good thing. And I have this, you know, my precious, it's mine, you know, kind of provincial feeling. But at the same time, I recognize that that's not cool. And I certainly don't mistreat people, although I will say I roll my eyes. The one thing that sets me off, like that Nerdy Bird comment I just made, and I follow her on Twitter and I read her stuff, but like, I don't like it when women assume that because they're attractive and wearing a genre costume that I'm going to fall over myself lusting at them. Frankly, there's more to it than that. So
at least the Nerdy Bird, I mean, like, I like her only because you can tell she knows her shit. She's definitely a comic book nerd. Exactly. But I don't trust that in a lot. And that's a reflection on me, not them, that I don't trust attractive people to be nerds. You know, that's totally my failing. And I have to say that I've really liked that nerd culture has gotten as popular as it has, because I have two kids who I've raised not specifically to be nerds, but just by being my children, are nerds. I mean, we play Dungeons and Dragons with them. We play Magic with them. My daughter is reading a Java programming book. Totally nerdy kids, right? But they also play sports. And they're also kind of the cool kids. They're punky Brewsters, and they're awesome. And that's accepted now.
Yeah,
and I love that, because my children won't go through that social anxiety and ostracization.
At least not until they're in high school.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly. It's accepted in girls up until you hit puberty, and then all of a sudden there's a switch that gets flipped.
I know.
And you're not supposed to be smart anymore, and you're not supposed to be a tomboy anymore, and you're not supposed to have any of these, you're not allowed any of these things anymore. I have to say that science fiction and fantasy has been my refuge for a very long time. I was never conventionally beautiful or attractive, but because I was very, very thin, very, very thin and flat-chested, and had very short hair, and often it was frizzy, but I wasn't ugly per se. But it still annoys me when I see a lot of it. It's just when I see the blatant sexism involved in the whole geek culture thing, where women have to meet a certain standard. I left all of that behind on purpose. I left the whole thou shalt read romance novels, thou shalt wear pink, thou shalt wear high heels and short skirts. I left all of that behind on purpose. And I feel like it's come back to haunt me. And that's why I resent it so much, I think.
Yeah, well, I think Hollywood has done a really good job of showing that guys can be, you know, slightly less attractive, socially awkward. That's acceptable for a nerd. Not so much for women.
No, still, not at all.
At least in Hollywood. Not at all. They still have to have big boobs, be hot, and look like comic book superheroes, women.
I'm under pressure to have big boobs and be hot too.
Well, granted.
And I, no, but seriously, I get kind of bummed out about some of the stuff I get because, and Sean, you sort of did this to me unconsciously before. I'm not trying to solicit an apology or anything, but you were like, Mike, I don't believe that you had that childhood based on your profile picture. You just did that. And the fact is, I did have that kind of childhood. And the thing is, I'm not trying to toot my own horn here, but it's my job to be in shape. Okay, I'm in the military. I was a PT officer for my past unit. You know, I have to be able to move quickly in body armor. I keep in good shape, and I have a short haircut, and I guess I dress reasonably well or whatever. And people are like, oh, you're not a nerd. You're not a nerd. You're making that up. And I'm like, fuck you. You know, this is my, like, that's like me walking into a room with a big cross or a crucifix around my neck and having people go, you're not a Catholic. Yeah, you don't look like a Catholic. You know, it's just like, this is my core, my roots, my life. And because I don't look like your stereotype of what I should, that I don't have possession of this thing. Like, that makes me crazy. And I get it all the time.
And that's one thing that I think is really interesting about the sudden sort of popularity of the nerd geek quote unquote movement. Is that suddenly we're seeing the stereotypes being like publicly defaced. Like there is no way now that we can say that like all of the Dungeons and Dragons players and the people who like video games are just guys who sit in their mom's basement, you know, and they have pimples and they're fat and they drink Mountain Dew all day, you know. Like,
yeah, because Vin Diesel plays D&D. So.
Right, Vin Diesel plays D&D. You know, you have people who
Vin Diesel has pimples?
Well, he might have when he was a kid. I don't know.
Judi Dench plays D&D.
Judi Dench.
You kidding me?
Hold on. Pardon me. That is
mind blown.
That is Dame Judi Dench. Dame Judi Dench. She is a knight.
Oh, jeez.
No fucking way. That makes me so happy. It's ridiculous.
Right, but the point is that now we're sort of seeing publicly that, well, no, anybody can sort of participate in this. It's not like it's something you should have to feel bad about for playing. Like, no, I can play. Anybody can play this. Anybody can be a part of this community if they happen to love it. And I think, and I understand the sort of that feeling of like, get the hell out of my house. Like, I grew up with this. This is a part of my identity. And you're just like getting on the popularity train. But there's also a side of that. It's like, no, this is actually good for us because it means
more
now this
sales.
Isn't. Well, more book sales, more movie tickets sold, those kinds of things.
It also means I have a real shot of playing a game of D&D with Judi Dench and Vin Diesel.
Right. See, exactly.
Oh my God!
Yay! Wouldn't that be awesome? That would be awesome.
That would be very epic.
Actually, I don't know if it could be more epic than the D&D game I got to play at Epic Confusion, the last Epic Confusion, with Peter Brett, Scott Lynch, Pat Rothfuss, Jay Lake, Elizabeth Bear, Jim Hines.
Why wasn't I there? Why wasn't I
there? You know, we'll probably do it again this coming Epic Confusion, so just make sure you come.
Okay.
All right, guys. So why don't we kind of close this out? I think we went from having final thoughts to talking about a totally different topic. but I think we should close out because we're running pretty long, and I think we've hit it really good. So I want to thank
can we close out with shameless plugs because we didn't get to introduce ourselves or
That's
talk about
what we're getting to.
This is true. No, I was actually just gonna close and just screw it for those people who have books to sell, whatever.
Okay.
And I'm just kidding. Actually that'd be a really good idea. So why don't we start with Mike? What is it that you've got coming out, or actually you just had a book come out not terribly long ago?
I'm the author of the Military Fantasy Shadow Ops series. The first book, Control Point, is in stores now. The sequel, Fortress Frontier, will be out in roughly 9 months from Ace. You can find me on my website at www.mikecole.com. That's MYKECOLE.com. You can follow me at Twitter at Mike Cole, again, MYKECOLE, or at Facebook at facebook.com/MikeCole.
Yep, and you should check out our interview with Mike. He actually came on the show and we read his book, and it's an awesome book.
We didn't read the book on the show, though. Just, I don't want to turn people off with that.
No, of course not.
Okay, yep.
Yeah, and then of course Stina Light, who we also recently interviewed. You've got a bunch of books. You want to like sell them?
Well, not like a bunch. I've got two. There's Of Blood and Honey and Blue Skies from Pain. And Blue Skies from Pain just came out in March and via Nightshade Books. And I am a Campbell Award nominee.
I know. I saw.
I know.
Christina.
It's so hard, by the way, because I saw you on there, and then I saw Karen Lord, and I was like, damn it, this is no longer an easy choice.
Yeah, the competition's pretty fierce, I have to say.
Yeah. But yeah, and your website?
Oh, www.cslecht.com.
Yeah.
I'm also on Twitter and Facebook under Stina Light, L-E-I-C-H-T.
Yep, and of course she's been on this show for both her books, and of course Mike will come on this show again.
Because the tone of your voice made it sound like if I didn't, you'd hurt me. So absolutely.
Yeah, because I could totally hurt you. Yeah, it's believable. And then of course Paul Weimer, who now has officially earned back his German ancestry.
Wunderbar.
Where can people find all the crazy stuff you're up to, Paul?
Well, they can follow me on Twitter. That's at PrinceJVSTIN. That's PrinceJVSTIN. I do columns, mind melds, and reviews for SF Signal. That's www.sfsignal.com. I do reviews and other things for the Functional Nerds, www.functionalnerds.com. At some point, probably in the next month, there will be reviews of both Mike Cole's books and Stina Light's and Blue Skies from Pain on the Functional Nerds. I know they're in the pipeline. They parcel them out a little more slowly than SF Signal, but I understand they are on the way. I've written them, and you should check those out so you can go and read Mike's and Stina's books if you haven't already, and you'd be a fool not to.
Yeah. Agreed.
Perfect. Thanks. And Jen doesn't have to say anything about herself because she's boring.
But so. I plan on giving birth to a cephalopod through my nose.
What?
That is so much cooler than anything I said. What a help not your birthday.
That will be my next big project. You can follow me at LoopDeLoo on Twitter.
Yep.
You should totally follow her on LoopDeLoo on Twitter if she's going to step the pod.
Oh my goodness.
Cool. Even if she doesn't, you should follow her.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. It's totally conditional for me. No cephalopod, no follow.
Crap. Oh. Now I'm going to have to actually do that. Okay, I'll figure it out. I just
Dude,
need,
really
you know.
That's really going to hurt.
I need an octopus to impregnate me, but.
I mean, they like latch on.
Your nose, just your nose.
But it'll latch on and stuff. Like, that's going to be hard to get out.
See, we are living in a science fictional universe where women get nasal passages get pregnant by octopi.
So weird. All right, guys. Well, thank you all for being on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
Yep. And we will hopefully have all of you on again. That'd be really awesome.
Yes, so. Please.
Alrighty. We will see everybody later.
Bye.
Ta-ta.
Bye.
Be seeing you.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus,
Shawnee Jen,
and or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.